we're moving into the second session of the session, I suppose, where we identified family management issues as a generic topic. So again, I'm open to questions, anything related to previous or head, but if you have things that relate to general family and life management issues.
Well, I'm wondering how we lost two potentially fine historians of science from history. I'm curious about that. There are actually very few Christian women in history of science. There's quite a few Christian men, but very few Christian women. I'm curious why you didn't pursue that route, especially Catherine, since you really apparently applied to grad schools, right, in history of science.
There's still time.
Can you say
which schools, what were your interests, why did you choose what you chose?
Yeah, so the programs I applied to, well, at least two that I remember being very excited about was Wisconsin-Madison and Virginia Tech. The decision not to go there, to pursue those, you know, to go into the hard sciences was because I also got into the Scripps Research Institute, which is a top 10 biomedical research programs. And so, you know, I had my father and a math professor and ironically a professor in the English department in college were all basically saying, like, there are many people who, you know, didn't go into the humanities. There aren't very many people who can do the kind of math that, you know, you're able to do. I wanted to apply math to biology, and the program at Scripps was very strong. But that said, it was hard. Like, I came from a small liberal arts school to a very competitive, very secular, very sink or swim kind of PhD environment, because at Scripps there's no undergrad, so grad students are kind of, you know, the bottom of the totem pole. And I got an NSF fellowship my first year, and with that I saw this ticket. I was pretty miserable actually my first year of grad school because I really just didn't know if I had what it took to survive. And you know, I started looking and reading the fine print of this fellowship. It was 3 years of funding, and it was transferable to other programs. So I started going over to UC San Diego to their history of science program, and they had these weekly seminars, and I'd go and I started talking to people, and I was like, seriously, I actually told, this is probably a mistake, but I actually told my PI in grad school, like, I think I want to transfer and go into this. And he was just like, what are you thinking? Like, it was a horrible moment, but, you know, but I realized, I think, at that point, like, this humanities crowd is not any easier. Like, it's hard, it's secular, it's very, you know, that's a hard road too. It's not like it's going to be any easier over there. And it wasn't like I was just searching for an easier way out, but just really looking for, you know, I felt like, whereas in undergrad I had just such a wonderful experience of exploring many different things, all of a sudden in a PhD program you're just so narrowly focused into one area, small area of research, and I felt like that was a little bit constraining. But I guess I really at the end of it appreciate it because it forced me to really do the hard work of, you know, setting up experiments and learning that humility of failing at experiments that you were talking about in your lecture this morning a little bit. I feel like there's a lot of growth as a person I did in just, you know, surviving. I mean, some people say grad school is, you know, the key to success there is just perseverance, like wait it out. And there's some truth to that, but you also have to publish and you also have to, you know, get the work done. And there were times I wasn't sure I could, but yeah, I still have affinities and love the kind of work you do, but yeah, I think a mix of practical, if PhD programs in history and philosophy of science gave out fellowships and of equitable sort, I think there'd be more people going into it.
That's a very fair point. Wisconsin is equivalent to Scripps. I mean, mm-hmm. Wisconsin might have been 1, 2, or 3 in the United States in history of science at the time you were applying, I'm guessing. Lindbergh and Numbers were still rolling along in that program, and they're both now retired. Mm-hmm. Indiana was definitely top three when I was there, maybe top two. And these were world-class programs. Mm-hmm. And so I felt the same way you did as a first-year student. I wasn't sure I could make it. I was a high school teacher before I went to grad school. Didn't really know if I could do this. I knew I could teach. Didn't know if I could do anything else. And it was, I had very similar feelings. Wisconsin has zero money for first-year students. Zero. I got admitted to Wisconsin too, and that's what they told me. So we just don't have any money at all for first years. And Indiana had none either, but they put me up for a university fellowship. I got one. So that's how I got to Indiana.
There are a couple of other hands in the back there. Questions?
Yeah, a couple of questions and comments that might segue into the family management issue, because Leslie, I really appreciate your comment about the resonance of passion and skill. I think it's very important, but I have some, it caused a lot of problems. I think pointed that out. There's some issues there, because what I see is the worst end of it is when someone's passion just does not match. No skills for what they're passionate about, it just does create a problem. But the one I wanted to focus on now is that both of those, but particularly passion, change over time. You know, because when you have to kind of make your choices, this is my field, this is where I'm going to get my education, that's not necessarily going to remain the same, which is a little scary, so how can I make a decision? But I really wanted to point back to something that happened at the ASA meeting about 7 or 8 years ago. Some of you were probably there, when we were discussing gender issues with the director of surgery at the University of Washington Medical School. And he was saying that he found that the women medical students were by far the best surgeons. They were really good at it, they loved it, and they were him. But he says, invariably, almost 100% after they got out, after they got into the field, found that their passions migrated to their maternal instincts and the family management issues. And it was a choice in terms of case where passions changed. And he dropped out. He says none of his best students remained doctors. So this is kind of something, I guess, as human beings we all face, and it's hard to predict, but I just wondered how some of you managed or experienced that kind of change, not necessarily that way.
Yeah, I mean, since, you know, my comments kind of spurred the question, maybe I'll take a stab at it first. That's a really interesting point, and I think that happened in my life, although my instincts didn't turn toward maternity, but I started out very, very passionate about human spaceflight. And, you know, here I was on a trajectory to very possibly fly in space and being, you know, trained to be an astronaut and working on the Hubble telescope, the International Space Station, accumulating lots of hours training and whatnot. And I'm trying to think exactly when I felt my passion start to change. And part of it was, I think, circumstances, part of it was politics, corporate politics and whatnot. But I started getting really interested in the science-faith intersection. And as that started happening, and the more I studied that, the more research I did, I have very little passion left for human spaceflight. That's still my area of research. I still, you know, it's the area where I, you know, publish the most and, you know, am professionally engaged the most. But it is not where my passion is anymore. My passion is now very much in the science and faith intersection, and particularly in communicating to students, college age and younger, that you don't have to make a choice between science and faith. Because for me, growing up, that was my biggest conflict. And that's partly why I went into political science in the first place, is I was a little scared to go into the sciences because I perceived that there was a conflict. And what I see with my students coming into APU today, a lot of them have already chosen either faith or science. And I feel like now that's my passion, is to show students that they don't have to make that choice. They can be both a good, faithful Christian and a good scientist.
I guess I think it's interesting that, I don't even know if it has to do with changing passions, but I've had female engineering students in my office asking me, how do I balance, you know, having a family later on with the career? What's it going to be like, you know? And I've never had a male student come in my office and ask me how they're going to balance their family responsibilities with their job. And every one of those girls, I said, look, it's a decision of a family decision. It's two parents who may have two careers. In fact, these days are probably likely to. And you too are going to have to figure out how you're going to balance that with your family responsibilities. And you know, I feel sometimes like I copped out a little bit, honestly, because I'm the one, as the female in my family, who reduced her job responsibilities to balance the family side. So I don't work full-time at Calvin. I'm at like 60 to 70%. Perfect for me. Calvin, having that opportunity to be a regular tenure-track faculty member at Lesson full-time, not very many places do that. There should be way more of that. But you know, my husband is kind of the real breadwinner, so to speak, because he works on, you know, a full-time job. But at the same time, he has switched jobs at times when his responsibilities became so heavy that he couldn't help, because if I'm working 70%, I'm not, you know, able to take it all. So some of those issues, I think we need to raise awareness with young people that the family will not be just the female somehow being responsible with, despite the fact that I do agree, there are maternal urges that tend to come to the fore later in your life, maybe when you were really gung-ho as a student. And there's research out there for engineers, female engineers, once they go into the career field, that they quit in larger numbers than males do. And part of it, I think, is cultural context of where they work.
Right. Yes.
Part of it is that engineers who are passionate about engineering like stuff. They like things, working with things. And not all the women do engineering because of that. They often choose engineering because it's a way to minister to society or, you know, make the world a better place. And then they get into the workplace and find that that's not enough to sort of carry them through the challenges. But that's a really interesting question. If there's other panelists that want to speak to that.
Autumn, does anybody else up here have kids? You got kids too, so. Two quick comments. I raised a family of three kids while I worked full time, but I was in an unusual situation in that my husband did not work. I didn't have a choice. I was the breadwinner. And so the way it ended up was, I was always stressed, but I dealt with it because I had no other choice. And when God puts you in a position where you have no other choice, you march forward every day, one step in front of the other, and you do the best you can. The other comment is, from an ASA point of view, from a, let's focus on the female part of ASA here for a little while in our ASA lives, I have wrestled with what should we, as perhaps mentors to younger students, or we're ASA, so what we represent an organization, what should we say to young women? Should we say, you know, you should always consult God and the Bible and, you know, follow your Christian heart? Should you, should you stand up for your women's rights and be sure that your needs are seen as equal with your husband's needs? This is controversial all through Christendom. And here we are dealing with women who are also in perhaps sciences or engineering, which is a little extra stress, a little extra unusual. And I don't know. I've prayed about this a lot as far as, you know, we reach out to women students. Should we have a corporate position on how to respond? Or
after your question, I have a question about that.
I'm an educator, parent, and I'm very interested in child development because we adopted an abused boy who has reactive attachment to son or did not bond with the mother. So I have no desire to heap shame or guilt on women who work, but I really have a desperate question. Can a child bond with the mother when she's absent in a high-stress job? And I would love it if some Christian woman would say to me, I did both and my kids are fine. Can anybody say that? Thank you. You know, I appreciate that because, you know, we all come from our experience. And, you know, I'm seeing this boy who's 21 who's still in a psychiatric prison because he didn't. Mm-hmm. And so I raised two girls myself home, and I started working when they were, you know, the youngest was in second grade, and I held a part-time job. But it is such an emotional high-stakes issue. And what is, you know, what is the research on child development? And they tell us kids' brains are hardwired by the time they're five. And a lot of, you know, yeah, there's neuroplasticity. We know more that, you know, the brain does change 25, in the 20s, 30s, even up to 70s and 80s now. The research says brains can adjust. But, you know, because of what I've been through for 10 years working to try to heal a child who didn't bond with the mother, I'd love to hear the other side. Anybody who wants to jump in on that?
Anything about that first for a while before I
jump in a little bit, because they put me on a panel up there when Ian was still in school. My son will turn 19 tomorrow. Okay. This is the first ASA he has missed in his life.
We miss him.
So did you put him in daycare at 6 weeks?
No.
Okay. This is what I'm asking.
She sent me the ASA. Yeah.
I dragged him along to lots of things. My husband was less employed than I am, so he could be in my office when I was in class. My career in terms of the general activity was down for his first 6 years. I wasn't publishing, but I was still teaching. I was still in the office pretty much 9 to 5. And the first 2 years, he was too.
So you had a flexible situation. You could bring your baby with you.
Yeah, but he was in daycare for part of the day after that.
True.
And then he was in nursery school, and then in school, starting at 4. Mm-hmm. So he was doing full day kindergarten or school.
But in those early years you were with him, what do you say to women whose job gives them 3 weeks, 4 weeks maternity leave, and then it's full-time daycare or you're out?
I don't think that by any means that ruins the child. Mm-hmm. But you've got to be able to say, my work has to end at 5, so that while this child is awake from 5 to 8, mm-hmm. I can give him. And then in the morning.
I know a lot.
But at the same time, the whole way through, with Wendy, and particularly when I was little, and all the way through his elementary school, I never felt like I was doing anything well. Mm-hmm. I was being an awful mother, I was being an awful wife, I was being an awful teacher, and I was being an awful engineer. I just stumbled through, did the best I could, figured that Proverbs 31 ought to be burned. And despite this, I think most people think I'm doing okay now, and my son is an amazing miracle.
But see, you had your baby with you those first couple years. I'm concerned for women who can't.
But
yeah,
there's an awful lot of women that I personally know, again, it's anecdotal, sorry scientists,
right.
It's just anecdotal, but my son was in full-time daycare his first 2 years. And he's 31 now, and he's doing just fine.
Doing just fine.
There's a lot of people I know, mm-hmm. who are two career people, mm-hmm. raising 1, 2, 3, 4 kids, and they're in daycare situations. And a lot of people accommodate in a wide variety of very creative ways.
Mm-hmm.
Part-time work, take them partly to the office, or you simply, I thoroughly agree, you feel like you're doing a half-assed job at everything, but you can't give up any one of them.
Mm-hmm.
So you accept that, mm-hmm. for a number of years. And I got by with a lot of sleep deprivation so that I could give full attention to my kids when I was home in the evening. I didn't sleep very much.
Mm-hmm.
And God helped me with that somehow. You know, I made it on through. So I think it's very, very possible to do, but it's a very private choice.
Mm-hmm.
And as I've worked with women here through ASA, my answer is always, it's a very private choice. And I know examples of everything in between, where women have set aside their careers for a broad number of years, where women have kept working full-time in very high-level jobs to have kids, or women who have said no to children, period, and had sterling and wonderful careers without, you know, having children. So I'm not saying everybody can do it and have it all, you know, and have the top-level jobs and the beautiful 2.5 children.
but
yeah.
it.
The other side is the cost to the women. You know, I see women
yep.
who are dropping their kids in daycare at 6 weeks and crying all the way to work and much of the day, and you know, just brokenhearted for those years when
yeah.
they want to be with that baby. And so that's another.
But I also know young women who are very modest about their enthusiasm for their children, and they really love their careers.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that my children
that's
are better off
too.
With my caregivers, so, at least some of the time. Yeah.
It does depend a lot, and that means the role of that caregiver, that daycare center person, is very important.
Yeah, daycare was absolutely for me in my career the most stressful thing to have to work out for me and my husband, both arranging for who was going to watch our kids.
Yeah.
I think men rarely have to think about that directly.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, that is
and
a dinner.
I could see that with my husband's
when,
too.
A man's wife dies when
right.
she when they're
mm-hmm.
very young, you know, and he has two children, and he's got to be it. But there can be a lesser dimension, I think. In our case, my wife put her, you know, was a teacher, and she supported herself before we married, and she put me through graduate school. But after that, she did not want to work full-time at all. She didn't go back to work part-time until our youngest was in first or second grade. So she did not want to, and so we made a conscious decision coming out of grad school not to try to get a job in the expensive areas, which means the Northeast, Chicago area, Washington, D.C., Research Triangle, mm-hmm. California. Three-quarters of the academic jobs that would be considered most prestigious are out the window. So we ended up in rural Pennsylvania.
It's one of the compromises you can make.
It was a decision we made together. She didn't want to work full-time. We knew on an assistant professor's humanities salary, we couldn't have gotten by very well in many of those areas. So there was a gender component to our decision. But it's not the same thing. I don't want to compare that. Say
no,
it's, same.
But that's,
it's not. But it is
just another example of a
that.
Family having to make.
That's a really great point. Economic decisions, you know, factoring in your lifestyle.
Right. It's a huge point.
Huge point.
Well, yeah. I might poke in here, kind of almost in reference back to what Gail was saying about her students approaching her. As someone, like I said, sort of early career, I'm very much still in the process of figuring out the trajectory that I want to be on. And it surprised me when I came out of grad school and was thinking about careers that I realized, you know, you start thinking big picture, what do I want in the future? And that's not just a career, but that could be, that is sort of family and things, and realized that I was thinking about not only what career do I want, but if I want to get married and have kids, I felt like I needed to factor that into my career choice. And so I was in the process of applying to both master's programs in education to go into teaching and PhD programs in theology, and had the opportunity to pursue each course. And it surprised me, being someone who, you know, going to a very liberal, secular school, a lot of feminism, a lot of like, I'm gonna do me and like my career, and like, I'm not going to, you know, bend what I want in my life for some man, but also, yeah, I do desire to get married, and I don't want to prohibit that future by a career choice either, but how much do you balance those things? And that's as much a question to all of you as it is something that I feel like I have to contribute, because I don't know how much I should be sort of directing myself career-wise now in the hopes of keeping doors open in the future in my personal life, but I don't want to give up things in my career for things that might not have happened. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So that's a tension that I'm living in right now that I don't know if anyone else has sort of navigated.
I've definitely thought about that a lot. So I have a 3.5-year-old and a 1.5-year-old, and I met my husband when I was in grad school. We got married when I was still in grad school, and we, you know, were figuring out all of that, but so we didn't have kids yet when I came to work for BioLogos, but that was definitely something that we wanted. I really didn't have any role models of women scientists who worked full time, who had children, who I thought were well adjusted. I mean, to be honest with you, I don't think that happens very regularly. The pressures are so intense, and you know, I did know women who put their kids in childcare at 4 or 6 weeks and you know, worked incredibly long hours and weren't there. I mean, I agree it's a family choice, but I guess I'll maybe say something somewhat unpopular in that, and maybe people have already alluded to this, but I do think it, like, our culture has totally bought into the, what I think is a lie, that you can do it all, right? You
yeah.
can have that perfect, you know, everything. And so we've made Robert choices. What's up? I think that, you know, I've felt convicted that I do want to be, you know, submissive to my husband and to really promote his career. I work part-time at BioLogos. And that those words, you know, nowadays are like, how can you say that? That's so backwards. But I feel biblically that as a wife and as a mother, I want to serve my family. And so, but I would say we're in a privileged place in that we could decide to work, that I could work part-time. I was working full-time until we had kids. And I know not everybody has that choice. And so people do have to do whatever it takes to take care of their families. And for many people that has two full-time, you know, career jobs. And I would never want someone to feel guilty about having to make that choice. You know, but if there are things that you can control, such as, you know, the size of your mortgage payment or things like that, you can scale your life in such a way that you can be flexible. But I mean, it means I don't pursue as many, working part-time means I don't get to do as much reading and writing and speaking as I would like. There's always many more projects I want to be doing and working on. I work really hard in the time that I have, and I have to, you know, just turn it off, like when I go home and be with my kids, and not always disciplined about that. Like I agree there's always a sense of like, you know, if I'm at work, what's going on at home? If I'm at home, should I be, I'm always like trying to think about work, and so having that discipline. I think men are in general, not to make too much of a, you know, I don't know, category statement, but my husband is really good at compartmentalizing, like, and I just can't. I'm always sort of blending work and personal things and everything.